We are kind of in a weird spot this week. We had originally, as we, you know, in our grand planning, decided to start a sermon series about a couple weeks ago, and then the Don't Waste Your Life thing kind of expanded a couple weeks longer. And so then we were going to start a brand new series. We were in the Don't Waste Your Life. We're going to do this one. I think this is going to be our logo. This is our first shot at it. It's called Be Killing Sin or It Will Be Killing You. And it's a direct quote from a very dead guy by the name of John Owen. He was an English Puritan in the 1600s, and he wrote a book that's probably one of the most classic works on the whole, how do you defeat sin in your life? And the book is called The Mortification of Sin. We've actually never done this before in our 12-year history or 11-and-a-half-year history. We've never actually just kind of went through a book, but we're actually going to have, if you want to get books, they're they're outside on the other side of this wall, and we got a good deal on, I think we bought 25 copies. We'll buy more if necessary. You don't need to buy the book. You can get it free. It's online free because it's an old book. You could get it online for free, and you could read along, or you don't even need to read along at all, whatever you want to do. It's fine, but we are going to kind of be going through it and covering some scriptural principles. We won't be reading the book or, you know, it won't become our Bible for that week or anything like that, but it still is going to be kind of our guide for we don't know how long. Until sin is dead in this church, darn it. So pack a lunch. We're staying for a while. I'm not sure how long. Probably like 8. We're looking at 8 to 10 or something like that weeks. It should be a fun time. So we're in the middle of this thing, and we decided, we're in between those two, and we thought kind of silly to start it this week and then go to spring retreat and do something. So we have something when we don't have anything else. We have something at Hope called Pastor's Open Mic. Huh? Basically, it says you could talk about whatever you want to talk about. And so that's what I'm going to do today. yeah, people are leaving. I thought about this long and hard. In fact, I did not make a decision, a hardcore decision, when I was going to do this till 10 o'clock last night, what I wanted to really talk about. I had 5 different things I thought about. And I thought, I don't think I'm going to stay for 5 messages. So we did one. I thought, this is the thought that came to me. It's springtime. You know it's spring because the grass it starts to look like that. That's not my lawn. My lawn still looks, you know, like, oh gosh, it's horrible. I cannot grow grass for anything. I've laid sod twice in the time that I've been in this stupid place. And I looked at it again this year, and it's more mud than, I don't know, has something to do with I'm raising 3 boys, I think. Not only that, but if you're like me and you like to get out, spring, March is the time for the opening trout season. The streams are open again. You got flowers going. Oh, it's just a great time. You take off all those clothes that you used to bundle up. I remember when the kids were little, they looked like this. You know, you had to bundle them like crazy. And you get rid of all that, and the thoughts turn to baseball. Today, at 3 o'clock, I have my coaches meeting for my Little League, which, of all the different things I do in life, if you put all the different hats, that's my favorite hat. And I'm not one of those crazy coaches that yells and screams too much. But we really love Little League, and that is a lot of fun. And so I've still got one kid left that I can live vicariously through. So baseball starts today. What else happens in the spring? What else happens in the spring? I noticed it on when I drove downtown on, was it Thursday or Friday? People just are, all of a sudden, they're kind of happier. They're outside. I saw my neighbor. I hadn't seen my neighbor in 3 months. I am not kidding. I said, oh, you're. And I saw this person. And not only that, but a young man's heart turns toward the young lasses. I know, I got 3 of them. And I was one. That's what springtime, that's what happens in the spring. Oh boy, ooh, giddy. Now, for those of you who know me well, know I encourage dating and Hope Community. We ought to, we do enough weddings, it's crazy. Well, I encourage it, I think it's great. But just let me just talk to the guys for a minute. Guys, the women in this church, I don't have any daughters, so they're kind of like my daughters. the women in this church are kind of like my daughters. And I just want you to remember a little math equation, all right? Here's the math equation. That plus that plus that. One more. There you go. It's so funny because actually, it's somewhat of a joke, but it's somewhat not. And I met Angie Hoagland. Now her name is, says with a Z, Zeal, yeah. I met her fiancé. They had never met me. He had never met me. I said, oh, okay, good to meet you, good to meet you. Well, I just gave him that whole thing. I said, the daughters, the women here at Hope, call them my daughters. And just on an unrelated note, I just bought a shotgun, I have a pickup truck, and I have a shovel. He looked at me like I was totally dead serious, like, uh-huh, uh-huh. So I kind of played it up for a while. It was kind of fun, actually. There's a great proverb on this. It says, there are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand, the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. Let me tell you, men, brain, gone, springtime. It's just, you see that girl, and it's just, that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about dating and relationships. To some of you in the room that, I don't know what our stats are anymore. Used to be, when we last took a survey in 2004, it was 70% of you are single. And 50% of you are undergraduate students, or roughly in that age category. You know, the 18 to, what's an undergraduate now? 31? 18 to 31? The U of M these days. You're in that category, and so I don't know if that's the case. This will totally apply if you're married also, or if you're seeking a spouse and you're not in that age group or whatever. This will totally apply to you, I hope. If it doesn't, it'll be a money refund at the end. I spent the good majority of yesterday reading a book. It's an okay book. Give it or take it. Writing's not the best, but it's called Good Christians, Good Husbands. And it's a book by Doreen Moore. And she's really a sharp cookie. I mean, it's amazing. I was amazed at how much footnotes. You read a chapter. This chapter right here has 168 footnotes. And it's a historical book. So she's looking, it's only, 21 minus 58. What's that like, 37 pages? 37 pages, 168 footnotes. So just a lot of historical references. So she's really quite the historiographer. This book is about three people in history, three who we'd call, in America at least, the founders of perhaps evangelicalism, or perhaps what they call revivalism, or whatever, in America. Even though two of them were British, they really helped found it. And they were both in the all three of them were in the 1700s, 1750s. First one was a man by the name of John Wesley. Anybody know who John Wesley is? Any good Methodist here? Methodist, Wesleyan, all that. Nazarene, you would all follow. The leader would be John Wesley. John Wesley was a great guy. I mean, he was a great guy. He was an incredible itinerant preacher. I think he preached 18,000 sermons in his lifetime. It's either he or Whitfield. I might get those two mixed up. One of them was 40,000. Anyway, they just preached, and they were itinerants. An itinerant preacher. This is a thing that we don't have a lot anymore. This is a dying thing. But what it used to be is a person used to go from town to town, spend no more than 6 weeks in a town. Then they'd go home, and then they'd go back to these different places. Revival meetings. Anybody grow up with revival meetings? You know what those even are? No. It's gone now. It's not a big thing anymore. But itinerant preachers used to come through. And Wesley was one of the best of them. And he, along with these other two guys that we'll mention in just a minute, kind of founded some of this amazing things. They really took the Bible seriously. They believed in the new birth. They called people to saying, you must be born again. You must follow Christ. You can't just have this intellectual assent of it. John Wesley fell in love with a woman. Her name was Grace. I believe her name was Grace. He fell in love with her, head over heels. She ended up marrying someone else. So on the rebound, he decided just to marry someone. He covenanted with his brother that he would never do that. He would never get married without his approval. Charles Wesley, the famous Wesley brothers. Charles Wesley wrote a lot of hymns. He said, I won't do it. He broke that covenant. He announced to his brother he was getting married in a week or 2 weeks or something like that. And he marries this woman. It is miserable. In fact, if you read biographies of Wesley and his wife, Molly, they'd say it's 30 years of hell. She left him several times. Finally, after 20-some-odd years of marriage, she finally leaves him in 1771. They get married in 1753, I believe. In 1771, she finally leaves him. They loathe each other. He, you know, is doing as polite a job with her as he can, and she is so bitter with him that she breaks into his private, where his private letters are, and hands over some of his questions and thoughts to his enemies. They publish them. Can you imagine that? Your wife taking your private diaries and giving them to your enemies so that they publish them. It was awful. It was an awful marriage. John, on his part, didn't really understand that for him to write, I'm going to call them what they are, romantic letters to other women when you're married might not be a good idea. He would say, oh, I just am so delighted to see you. No one fills my world like you do. She'd get a hold of these, you know, and she'd be off the handle. He'd say, I can write to anyone I wish. This marriage was so awful. In October of 1778, they were now split up. They never did legally divorce, but they were divorced for all practical purposes. He wrote her this at the end. He said, as it is doubtful, considering your age and mine, whether we may meet any more in this world, they hadn't seen each other for years, I think it right to tell you my mind once for all without either anger or bitterness. I'm just going to shoot straight with you here about something. Let me tell you this. Here it is. If you were to live 1,000 years, you could not undo the mischief you have done. Until you have done all you can towards it, I bid you farewell. It's a nice way of saying take a long walk off a short pier. She dies in October of 1781. He doesn't even go to the funeral. That would not be what you'd call a happy marriage. Second one of these big three was a guy by the name of George Whitefield. George Whitefield also falls in love with a woman. But he is a little smarter than Wesley. In other words, he's going to let his intentions be known up front. He's going to say, you know what? I'm first married to God. And second, I'm really married to ministry. I'm going to do this itinerant thing. I'm going to be gone a lot. Are you okay with that? He writes this woman's parents, and he says this, for I bless God if I know anything of my own heart. I am free from that foolish passion which the world calls love. He's writing this to the parents. I write only because I believe it is the will of God that I should alter my state. I just want somebody to help me. I got too much going on here. I need some help. So then he writes to the woman and he says, the passionate expressions which carnal courtiers use, I think, ought to be avoided by those who would marry in the Lord. I can only promise, by the help of God, to keep my matrimonial vow. And to do what I can towards helping you forward in the great work of your salvation. If you want love and candy and flowers, I'm not the guy for you. Now, at least he told her up front. He did tell her up front. She turned him down and got married 2 weeks later to another guy. However, he also just decides, he runs this orphanage in Georgia. He's from England, but he's over here and he runs this orphanage in Georgia. He's planning on moving here and he wants a wife to run the orphanage. That's what he really wants. Now, I don't totally get it. But he marries somebody by the name of Elizabeth. She gets it. And they have an okay relationship. But it's not anything that we would call healthy. Oh my goodness, no. The last one of the three. He's a guy I've been mentioning before. I took a class on him. It's a guy by the name of Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards. Now, if you were here on Good Friday, you heard Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. That is That's very true. He definitely believed in a real hell. But it's not really fair to put that on Jonathan Edwards that that was what his only thing was. No. Edwards, by more than any other theologian at that time, was really blown away by the love of God. And Edwards was a lover. Listen to this letter he wrote to Sarah Pierpont, later to be his wife. They say there is a young lady in who is beloved of that great being, capital G, capital B, who made and rules in the world. And that there are certain seasons in which this great being in some way other or invisible comes to her and fills her mind with exceeding sweet delight. And that she hardly cares for anything except to meditate on him. That she expects after a while to be received up where he is, to be raised up out of the world and caught up into heaven, being assured that he loves her too. Well, he loves her too well to let her remain at a distance from him always. She's talking about her relationship with God. There she is to dwell with him and to be ravished with his love and delight forever. Therefore, if you present all the world before her with the richest of its treasures, she disregards it and cares not for it and is unmindful of any pain or affliction. She has a strange sweetness in her mind and singular purity in her affections. It is most just and conscientious in all her conduct, and you could not persuade her to do anything wrong or sinful if you would give her all the world, lest she should offend this great being. She is of a wonderful sweetness, calmness, and universal benevolence of mind, especially after this great God has manifested himself to her mind. She will sometimes go about from place to place, singing sweetly, and seems to be always full of joy and pleasure, and no one knows for what. She loves to be alone, walking in the fields and groves, and seems to have someone invisible always conversing with her. Edwards was blown away by her relationship with God, and he fell head over heels in love with this woman. He was 20. She was 13 when he wrote that to her. Now, can you imagine being her daddy and you read that letter? He was in love with her. He flat out loved this woman. And their marriage is an amazing, amazing marriage. So if you ever do a study of that period of time, read about Edwards and Jonathan and Sarah Edwards and their relationship. And it was amazing. In the midst of a very crazy schedule. Now, I bring that up because I say this. Whitfield and Wesley are quoted as two of the most godly people. You can do research on anything. A lot of people like to quote Whitfield and Wesley for a lot of different things. And their marriages were at best dubious and at worst scandalous, terrible. Dating and marriage is a very, very, very complicated thing. And what I want to do this morning is just spend some time talking about how can you, and especially if you're not even in a relationship yet, how can you make some groundwork so that it makes it a little bit more stable? If you're already there, that doesn't mean you're doomed. I'm a total optimist on this. I don't care where your relationship's at. Christ can transform. Now, with that said, I need to give some definitions because most of you don't even know what I'm talking about. So, let me give you some definitions. We're not talking the same language here. Let me give you your language. I say dating. You say hanging out. All right? What I mean by dating is any appointment with the opposite sex. That's a date. That's simple, okay? It's an appointment. It goes in your what? Date book. That's a date. We have a date. You call it, we're just hanging out. Now, men, women do not think you are just hanging out, even though they say, we're just hanging out, which leads to the DTR, the dreaded DTR. The dreaded DTR is we've been hanging out for quite a while. What exactly are we? Generally, that's not in the masculine tone. Generally, it's the female voice saying, what is this? And guys say, I don't know. You are at this moment testing your right guard, seeing how far your deodorant will last. I mean, you are freaking out. Give me a warning. Don't just crack that question off like that. I don't know. This is the dreaded DTR. What is the relationship? Anybody been through that? Okay, chickens. All right. If it lasts through that, then you all say, we're together. We're hanging out with a capital H, capital O. I don't know what you say now. I called it courtship. It's you and me, baby. Okay, that's the you and me baby phase. And if somebody else were to come in, it wouldn't be comfortable anymore. We all tracking here? You're grooving on the phases here? All right. Next phase is what I'd call engagement. Now, you're not engaged until you have an engagement, which means you have a date to be married. We're engaged when you get married. I don't know. You're not engaged. It's a nice ring. Looks nice. But you're not engaged. It means I have a date. We've picked a date. That's when you're engaged. Some of you, though, are engaged before you have a ring or you're engaged, which is really weird, but that's okay. You got this date, but we haven't asked yet, and that's kind of interesting, but that's all right. Whatever. It's the 90s. Don't give me an open mic. It's not good. Then that leads to marriage. It's all happy from there, sunset, no big deal. Now, I want you to know what the point is. What is the point of this whole thing? I want to show you two passages. We're going to fly through a lot of things this morning. It looks like there's a lot of points. We're really going to go through pretty, really, really quick. I'm just going to make mention of these. What's the point? Ephesians 5 is probably one of the best passages in the Bible, and what's the point? Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds it and cares for it just as Christ does the church, for we are members of his body. I'll just do that much. The rest is there for context purposes. Why get married? Right? What's the ultimate thing? And what is happening here is Paul saying, here's what you're supposed to do. Here's how you're supposed to act. Husbands, you're supposed to love your wives. You look at the end of the passage here. It says, wives should respect. The word is submit. I'm not going to go there today, but that basically means to honor and to say, I champion you. That's what that is all about. It doesn't mean yes, sir, no, sir. That's not what it means at all. Read biblically about good wives. But it says here, why do you do that? And he says, just as, and here's the analogy, Christ loved the church. So the analogy of marriage is something that's supposed to show off to the world how much Jesus loves his church. So if your marriage looks like Wesley's, it sucks. It's an act of God that Wesley was able to be used by God. Because his marriage is supposed to be a light, and it wasn't. And it says here, if you look at it, it says, what does Christ do? Verse 25, he gives himself up for her. You know, oftentimes we talk about this, men, if you're in this relationship, biblically, I believe, you are the leader. But define what leadership means here. It means you're the one who gets to give up. That's what it means. It doesn't mean, oh, great, I want Burger King, you want McDonald's, we're going Burger King. It means just the opposite. You go to McDonald's. You serve. It says to give himself up for her, to make her holy. This is what Jesus did to the church. To cleansing her by the washing with water through the word and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Why does Jesus do this? To present her to himself as a beautiful bride. Guys, what's your goal in all this? I want some arm candy. No, your goal in all of this is to so deeply touch that woman that you're either dating, engaged to, or going to be married to, that she becomes more and more, she like a rose opens up and she becomes more and more like Christ. She becomes everything that God intended. You're supposed to touch her that way, minister and move in her life that way. Woo! Big calling. Glad my wife is in this service. That's what my calling is. That's what your calling is. That's what dating's about. It's not about just, oh, I just want somebody to go to a movie with. You know, get a dog. I guess that doesn't work, but f- Flip back to Isaiah 62. I skipped past it. My bad. Isaiah 62 talks about this analogy too. And it talks about how God uses the analogy of marriage to talk about his relationship with us. Go down to verse 5 there, just in the interest of time. As a young man marries a maiden, so will your sons marry you, talking about God. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. Marriage is ultimately, good marriage makes people look at it and go, there's something different about you guys. I don't know what it is. And it's not just that I'm a really good husband. It's that God's working in your life. It should scream to the world, Jesus. It's amazing. Now, how do you do that? What's the plan? What's the biblical kind of setup so that you can get there? I want to flip back to Genesis chapter 2. First relationship, okay? Genesis chapter 2. And I want to go through and I just want to list out four different things. What kind of the plan, the sequence that you should have in order to make yourself a person who's not just going to get caught up and end up with years and years of suffering. First thing, Genesis 2. It's verses 7 to 25, but we're not going to read all those. We're just going to read portions of it. It says, The Lord God formed Adam, the first man, the man, from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. There's Adam, there's God, he breathes into him, he comes alive, and there's no sin in the world, and Adam and God had this perfect relationship. Number one, most important thing, by far, if you want to be a great husband, a great wife someday, number one, have your Lord set up right. Number one, God is his Lord or his master. I don't ever do this, but I do it this way for this particular message. They're all going to start with M. I kind of hate that, but anyway, who's his master? All right? That's the most important thing by far. If you're here and you want to be a good husband or a good wife, the number one thing is to let Jesus Christ be your Lord. Follow him. Because you are created by God to worship something. And if you don't worship him, you're going to look for something else. And I can tell you what it is. Marriage. Marriage is an idol, I-D-O-L, factory. You just looked at the person saying, fill me, fill me, fill me, fill me, fill me, fill me. It's like a tick on a dog. Problem most marriages, what? Two ticks, no dog, right? Yeah. Just sucking off each other. Why? Because you will worship something. You're designed to worship. It's freeing when you worship God and you come to each other not as a source, you come to each other as a resource. Huge difference. Second thing, God then planted a garden in the east in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed. Second thing, God gave him a mission. He had a job. Men, if you're going to date my daughter, get a job. Get a job. Have a purpose in life. Have something you're trying to accomplish. Third thing, after all of that, Eve isn't even created yet. Then Eve gets created. It's not good for the man to be alone. Make a helper suitable for him. He made the woman from the rib. The third thing then is then God gives him the woman, gives him a date. And then lastly, verses 24 and 25, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. The man and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. Fourth thing, then God gave them the safety and the comfort and the beauty of marriage. But it follows that order. It follows that order. God first. Come to know Christ. If you don't know Christ yet, come to know Christ. Follow him. Take some time to get to know Jesus. And so you're not just all of a sudden saying, oh, I can do this other thing. That's okay. It takes time to make sure that he is everything to you. Then you're not coming to someone as needy. You're coming to someone else as a resource. Then go and find your mission. God, where are you calling me? What do you want me to do? Then look for a relationship. And lastly, for marriage. In my life, when I was in college, I was part of a campus group called the Navigators. Remember Robbie? That's what they're called, right? Yep. We call them the never daters because they didn't date. They didn't date. In fact, women were afraid of the second date because the first date you go out and second date you ask them to marry him. It's like, whoa, hello, good morning. That's the tradition. I feel God leading me to ask you to marry me. Geez, what's your name again? I was told by the staff person when I was a freshman, he said, I think it would be a good idea if you didn't date at all in college. I thought, he said, I think it'd be a good idea if you just got, you know, your life in order and you just learn to follow Christ and all that. Now, I still to this day think that's terrible advice. However, the idea is saying, you know, maybe just take a little bit of time and get that figured out. I think it was a good piece of advice. But somebody telling me what the period of time. And I remember I've only been part of the organization 2 weeks, and I only had been a follower of Christ for 2 weeks, and I knew something was a little screwy there that reeked of cult. So I didn't take that advice, you know. I tried really hard, but no one would date me in college, so there you go. I encourage that, though. I think if that's a place where you're at right now, man, that's great. Others of you, let's get dating. What's the deal? Let's get dating. You know what? Men, just right now, look around this room. I'm totally serious. If I'd come in here as a college student, goodbye. I mean, this would have been the I've hit the jackpot. They're godly, cute, wonderful women. But remember, men, I own a shotgun, a pickup truck, and a shovel. You treat them right. But it's great. It's great. Okay. Now, with that said, a couple last things here. Relationships the way God intended. My belief is that until you are married, you treat that woman as an honor. You honor her. Listen to this verse from 1 Timothy. Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. If you remember from the very end of Genesis chapter 2, it said the man and the woman were both naked and felt no shame. That's the ultimate goal of marriage, is not just physical nakedness, but every area of life to be naked and feel no shame. Well, until you're married, though, there should be some clothes on in every area. Every area. Emotionally, financially, time, relationships, every area. There's some holding back. My goal when I dated Carol was that if I were to stand up here not on this stage, but South Bend, Indiana, and I were to say, the preacher were to look at me and say, do you marry her? Or would you take her? I'd say, I do. And he looks at her and she says, what was I thinking? No. That if she walked away from our wedding day, that I could go to her wedding, look at her husband, and say to her at him at the reception, I did nothing to defraud your wife. Make that your goal, men. Women, make that your goal. It's what it says here. Therefore, short engagements, I'm all for them. They're great. They're wonderful. I have no problem there. Mine is 5 months. No problem. You can do it. We did one in 4 weeks down here. So that's great. But treat each other honorably. Next thing. What's the big idea then? The big idea in marriage, the big idea in any relationship, and especially in marriage, is from Romans 12:10. Love one another with mutual affection. And I love the way that NRSV says this. Outdo one another in showing honor. Make it your competition to see who can outdo the other one. Now, I'm going to say something controversial here. You can put it in your pipe and smoke it. If you don't like it, that's fine. Carol and I made a covenant early in our relationship to eliminate sarcasm. Now, you know what sarcasm means? Sarcasm, if you look it up in the dictionary, where the Latin phrase it comes from, it's actually a Greek phrase. It means cutting of the flesh. So if I wake up in the morning and go, nice coffee. How does that go over? Well, it's just a joke. Was it? Not really. There's something to it. There's something to it. There's teasing. But there's this sarcastic way of talking that is ultimately just trying to chop down constantly. I know we kind of grow up on that, that's funny and everything. Like I say, it's controversial. You can, that's our love language. Okay, all right. As long as I hear a lot of other things that really communicate your heart to that person, I'm going to challenge you. I actually had a roommate in college. Before I did this with Carol, I had a roommate in college that we made a covenant to no longer, we heard a message on this, sarcasm is cutting of the flesh. We said, we're not going to be sarcastic with each other. We made that commitment in 1985. It was the hardest commitment I'd ever done because I found out that was my mode of speaking and his too. We still to this day, it took us about 4 months to get it figured out. We still to this day, and we hunt and fish together. We still don't. We aren't sarcastic with each other. Don't get me wrong. We razz each other pretty hard, but it's not sarcastic. It's pretty straightforward. You suck at making coffee. That ain't sarcasm. That's just true. Okay? So that's fine. Let me close with four questions. Four questions to ask. These were asked of me. A guy asked me once when I was just totally infatuated with this girl. And it was just a girl in college. I didn't really know her all that well. He asked me a question, and I've morphed these into four questions. He asked me one question. The question was this. You think it's the best thing for her that you date her? Boy, what a great question, huh? Wow. Do I think it's the best thing for her that I date her? Or flip the, you know, if you're a woman, flip it to him. Then flip that. Is it the best thing for you that you date her? Is that a good thing for you? It's a good question to ask. Third one, is this consistent with what I feel is God's call in my life? In other words, is this the best thing for the kingdom that we're involved in this? And then the last thing is God in this? Is this God's leading or am I forcing this? And let me just tell you right now, you are all going to answer that question totally. Just ask somebody outside who you trust. Say, do you see this? Is this a good thing? And then listen. And then listen. We're going to move to a time of worship and communion. And you think, wow, that's kind of a radical shift from where we've been here. I don't think so. I don't think it's any accident that God makes the relationship between a man and woman in the context of marriage his analogy of what it means that he loves you. If you've seen or been part of a good marriage, and I think I am in a good marriage. We have moments. Dude, we have moments. Anyone who's lived in our house knows we have moments. But there is something I know at the bottom end of it, everything else, I know that Carol has my heart and I have hers. I know that without any wondering. That is an analogy. That's an imperfect analogy of what this table's all about. This is Jesus Christ down on one knee saying, I want to marry you. I want you to be mine. He says in Ephesians 5, why does he do all this stuff? To present to himself a beautiful, spotless bride. And you're that bride. That's how much he loves you. It's crazy. He loved you enough that he went to the cross to die to pay your penalty, your sin that you should be punished eternally for in hell. He goes to the cross and takes it. And now he's down on a knee saying, will you marry me? If your answer to that question this morning is yes, we invite you to come and take communion. We invite you to come to renew that vow or to start it for the first time. Today might be your first time. You say, you know what, Jesus Christ, I'll let you be my husband. Of course, you know, spiritually speaking. There's tables in the back. There's tables upstairs. The bread represents his body. The cup represents his blood shed for you. And you can come and you can take it. Just come down this way to the front. Is that right? Or they go this way. Yeah, come down this way, grab. And then there'll be people down front and at every place. We'd love to pray for you, anything at all. We'd love to pray for every person here. Just whisper something into our ear. Or if you don't have anything specific, just pray a general prayer, a blessing for me. And we'd love to do that too. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up, and then we're going to move to a time of communion and prayer. Would you pray with me? Lord Jesus, I thank you more than anything that no topic is off limits in your word. I love that it talks about things just as the way we see them. Father, I pray. I pray for our church, all the people here and will come next service and who won't hear this service this week, and just all of them, God. I pray for their relationships. I pray for those who are married, God. I pray, Jesus Christ, that you would do a special work in those relationships, that they wouldn't be difficult, and they wouldn't be hard, but they would be relationships where they're trying to outdo one another in love. God, I pray for those who've gone through the pain, like Wesley, and have gone through the pain of divorce or separation. God, I pray that you would be their hope. And God, if there would be at all possible, there'd be reconciliation. And God, if that's past that point, that you'd just do a work, whether in a new relationship or whatever you would have, God. We just ask for your healing hand upon those. I pray, Father, for those who've gone through a quote-unquote divorce, even though it's just been in a dating relationship. That's very painful, and I ask for your healing hand in their life. I pray for those, God, who right now here are in the midst of wondering what you'd have for them. And I pray, Father, that more than that they'd find the right person, God, that they would be the right person. And that they would seek after you and make you their real strong master. They would look to you as their Lord. God, I pray that you would just do your work in our lives, even this spring. And I pray, God, for people in this room that the marriages that ultimately come out of this would be a godly legacy for years to come. Lord Jesus, I praise you for this table and what it represents. You down on one knee with a gleam in your eye saying, "Will you marry me?" Let's pray this all in Jesus' name.